The Burger Krieg Productions 15 Minutes of Fame podcast features Tyler, guitarist of Black Mesa and mastermind behind the latest project Super Ghost. Here's a Black Mesa tune, Electric Gun.
We are live. It's, you know, this is a Skype call, so I feel obligated to say that we're not officially endorsed by Skype, but, you know, I guess stranger things might happen in the future. But who knows? I mean, I'm clearly thinking that this is more than it is. But either way, Tyler, welcome. Welcome to the show, as it were.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Dude, not a problem. I was very excited when we got this kind of lined up because I've obviously spoken to Nate a couple times, and I love chatting with him. Very intelligent individual, but I know that you're also a very fascinating human as well. So I wanted to give you a platform, you know, and we have some exciting news to, I guess, break on during this episode too. So I was very honored that you wanted to do this with me.
Yeah, and by comparison, you know, if Nate in his interviews is kind of like a college course, this will basically be Black Mesa for dummies. So, you know, it should be easily accessible for anyone between the ages of 9 to 99.
Nice. I like that span too. You know, I feel like anytime something is that accessible, it's almost dangerous, you know? So out of the gates, I guess, one of my first things, I want to address. Now, for those listening, you know, Black Mesa, I guess for those listening who are not familiar, Black Mesa, you're a three-piece band comprised of drums, synth/vocals, and searing guitar work. Now, from your perspective as a guitarist, what are some of the upsides and downsides to being the only string player in the band?
Well, a definite downside is, you know, kind of having to sort of be like the bassist in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. because, you know, I feel like the dynamic between bass and drums is like so important, and especially for the timbre between bass and drums, where you just have like that kind of like really like, whether it's like the sort of like thumb picked kind of sound or like the really diggy, you know, really aggressive bass playing, like that dynamic between drums and bass, like I really like that on a lot of records. Mm-hmm. So for Mesa, like I feel like a lot of my duty is to simultaneously, you know, provide the riffola, but also have like the strong underbelly, because if Nate, you know, is out near the Andromeda galaxy, you know, I need to be the one that kind of brings it to, you know, back to Earth.
Right.
So that's like the one downside, but I will say if there's any upside to it, you know, it very much reminds me of sort of like the dynamics that you would get with a band like the Doors, at least in the live context. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, live, they didn't play with the bassist. They just had Ray Manzarek, you know, using both his the organ. I think it was like a Bass Rhodes or whatever. But yes. Like, that kind of like, it kind of like makes you tilt your head, you know, if you're a concert goer, because you're like, wait a minute, something's missing here. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we pull it off, and then by the end of it, you know, they don't care that there isn't a bass player on stage. It's pretty cool. It's definitely a nice little niche that we got going on.
Since the project started, since you entered into this, I guess, blood pact with the crew, have you had any major breakthroughs in your technique or style, being the primary riffola, you know, connoisseur, if you will, of the band?
Really, it comes down to, you know, finding the tasteful moments where I can kind of dance in the avant-garde along with Nate. And a lot of that is using, you know, feedback, delay and reverb, you know, the occasional modulation. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I really, really enjoy, you know, when it comes to like kind of like going off. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like other kind of breakthroughs, like, I don't know, like, I mean, I've been playing guitar now, I mean, seriously for, geez, about 20 years mm-hmm. now that I'm thinking about it. And in that time, you know, you figure out your technique, you figure out what really is your voice. Did I really want to play like Tom DeLonge back in my eighth grade infancy? Did I, you know, pick up, you know, some tricks from like Kim Thayil or Joe Perry or, you know, whatever flavor of the moment guitarist kind of shows up for me? Really just about, you know, taking, you know, the tools that I have, whether literal or the metaphorical with like my hands mm-hmm. and, you know, seeing what other kind of things I can kind of pick out. And fortunately, you know, I'm very grateful to be, you know, around, you know, I mean, just the insanity that is Nathan Cervone, in terms of what he does with the synthesizer and also with his voice and sometimes his whole body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, John Fay, you know, is just a master, you know, and very, instrumental towards, taking some cool new paths mm-hmm. to, discovering cool sounds in the live setting period, which, you know, boy, it was such a trip, you know, playing our first show back, what was it like, 2 weekends ago in mm-hmm. Albany, which again, thank you again for putting us on that bill. Thank you, Burger Creek Productions. You know, just playing live, you know, there's a certain energy that you don't get just being three dudes in a rehearsal room, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, just sitting there on your couch, you know, trying to make, you know, a song happen. Like when you're around other people that either know your stuff or have no idea what you are, you know, you kind of have like that kind of curiosity mixed with nervousness, mixed with excitement, mixed with, I got to go to the bathroom, mixed with, what other kind of feeling, reaction, action, you know, that comes in the live setting, you know, to basically lift one of my favorite quotes from the show, I think was, I Think You Should Leave on Netflix, you know, we create a cosmic gumbo.
I think that's an appropriate, that'd be an appropriate analogy, I guess, or the symbolic element of what you, the three of you accomplish. Now speaking, I guess more to those individuals again, who might not necessarily be familiar. I like asking this question because it varies. And I think that Black Mesa, is a perfect, we'll say perfect example for this question and how this question can be very interesting, or the answer to this question. How would you personally describe the music of Black Mesa to somebody who's never heard the band before and who may not know you personally? Do you think that cosmic gumbo is the appropriate response there, or would might you use something else?
That answer kind of dictates on my mood, or rather, you know, it's really dependent on it. So let's say if I'm just not really in a great mood and someone asks you, oh, so you play music, what's your band like, I'll usually just say rock and roll. And I'll just not elaborate any more awesome. Than that, because, you know, sometimes that's all you need to say. Oh, so you're like a metal band? No, rock and roll.
That's awesome.
Oh, so like you're like a punk rock band, rock and roll. Like, I'll just do that. But like, if it's someone that I could tell that, you know, has listened to their fair share of, you know, Black Flag records, especially like the spoken word shit, or, you know, definitely can kind of get a little weird. Just like, I don't know whether it's the person just verbatim telling me what they listen to, or if they're wearing a t-shirt. That's usually like the biggest dead giveaway, by the way, what they're wearing. Mm-hmm. That's where I'll maybe like go like, oh, well, you know, like, do you like Converge? And like, oh yeah, I like Converge. Okay. We don't sound anything like Converge. And then I'll, you know, sort of like go at it from there. So oh, I don't awesome. Know. Like, it really kind of depends on like how I'm feeling when someone's asking you that. Like, if it's someone that, you know, I really like, let's say if it's an aunt or an uncle, I'll mm-hmm. just say, oh yeah, it's rock and roll. And they go, oh, okay. And they just kind of leave it alone.
Right.
You know, with us, it's like you, and then I think for a lot of bands, like, I think it's so much more liberating to not really have like a genre attached. you know, to be able to go, like, you can't really define us. And I know that sounds pretty lofty to think that way, because there is always a root to everything. There's always a reason why I'll hit the guitar, you know, with a chord a certain way, or why Nate is going to scream a certain way, or how John hits the drum. Like, there's always going to be some kind of influence in there. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, to kind of say that, you know, you can't really put a real tab on what we do, you know, that I think is the coolest thing.
And I think that point specifically about rock journalists creating genres and subgenres to literally and metaphorically box artists in, I almost think in addition to that, it's also that because of the nature and the business that they're involved in, they paint a picture with words. So think about the first journalist that like coined some of these terms that we use either seriously or ironically. It's like they probably did that because they're like, whoa, people are going to wonder what this is. And then they're going to dig deeper. And now I'm going to categorize these other bands like post-punk, for example. It's like, think of that entire genre now. It's like, I bet you if you fucking woke up Ian Curtis from his eternal slumber and you asked him about post-punk, he'd literally look at you with dead eyes. No pun intended on that one. Like, it doesn't make, it's almost foolish, right? So if it all stems from rock and roll, it's like, you're being more accurate than I think you may or may not give yourself credit for. That's like, that's one of the more true statements, you know? It's like, it's all fucking rock music, you know?
Yeah, I figure if we tried to wake up Ian Curtis, I'm pretty sure he would just be like, leave me alone.
Let me go back to bed. Let me go back to bed, please. Changing gears to film. Now, I've noticed from some, we'll call it a healthy amount of stalking from some of your social media pages, it appears that horror film in some way, shape, or form is a constant, or it has been a constant for you. And what I want to know is, you know, if you could name for me, what were a couple of the first horror films that you remember truly terrifying you as a child?
As a child, so in my adolescence. I mean, not for nothing, the episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark where it had fucking Nosferatu.
Mm.
Like, that was like, there was the point where like the hand is like, you see like those long fingernails and it's like, oh, he's coming this way. Like, that was pretty terrifying for a kid's show, you know? Like, I don't want to say it did damage, but that was something where it was like, oh my God. And then, like, not even, like, really in the horror aspect. I mean, Total Recall,
dude,
when, you know, the eyes are popping out of the head. That's really freaked me out. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about, you know, the horror genre and, you know, my adolescence, it would probably have – you know what it was? I think it was not so much watching the movie, because I was too chicken shit to watch it at the time. But I remember there was a commercial, it was on for WPIX. It was WB11. Mm-hmm. Let's see how many of my tri-state homies know about this one. But that was like when they would do like the Wednesday movie night, or it was like Thursday movie night. And one of the films they were doing was like one of the Jason films. And I remember there was like some shot where it's like you see Jason like just totally just rampage on just some poor, you know, woman that was like in a closet. And I remember it was just like this, like this very quick shot. And I was like, that's the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. And it's on at 8 p.m. I cannot watch this.
It's on at 8 p.m. That's the best detail of that whole thing.
Like, I need to change the channel, because, you know, here I'm trying to, like, you know, watch, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reruns at the time. I'm like, I can't watch this. I need to go to a safer place. So I think that would have been, you know, the earliest impact of horror from an early age before I eventually went down the rabbit hole to the present day.
So when you first kind of started down that rabbit hole and got exposed to what I would guess, you know, a mixture of classic horror films of the time, et cetera, were there any that you can recall that when you saw them for the first time, they truly still hold up in the sense like they still kind of creep you out when you watch them. So think about a movie you saw a while ago and like it's still, there's moments when you watch it today or if there's stuff that you rewatch every once in a while that like still kind of give you the fucking heebie-jeebies.
Probably right now, I would say The Wailing, which for those that are not in the know, was a South Korean horror film. It was released in the last decade. And, you know, if you love your Exorcist kind of movies, I mean, this is that kind of concept, you know, just ratcheted way the fuck up. And I mean, not only the fact that it just holds up as a brilliant film, you know, in terms of the art form of making a movie, it is incredible. But add in the fact of the horror elements of it. Like you have this one sequence where, you know, they're trying to expel the demon, you know, from our protagonist's daughter. And you see the sort of dueling ritual between both the good guy and then the demon who's in his shack somewhere in the woods that has like a bunch of like, you know, dead chickens or whatever. And like just seeing like that back and forth, like I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but it's just insane. And just it's loud visually, it's loud like audio wise like I think someone who did the mixing just like pushed everything into the red, and it was like that kind of thing. Like thinking about it right now, I'm like, God, I just want to rewatch just that whole sequence, because you know it's just absolutely incredible. And definitely, you know, to this day I think really kind of holds up as like a big oh shit moment.
So that's The Wailing, you said, and that's a Korean film?
Yeah, I think it's The Wailing. I think it was like Goksung. I think it's kind of like in parentheses. Last I saw, like I know Hulu was hanging on to it for a long time. You know, I highly recommend it. You know, if I had to do my horror pick that isn't, you know, forcing someone to sit down and watch Salo or Serbian film, it is to watch The Wailing, Goksung.
There's something about foreign horror films or foreign thrillers that have aspects of horror, and it doesn't matter what kind of horror, bodily horror, you know, demonic possession, et cetera, et cetera. There's something about foreign films, I think, that especially watching when I was younger, like seeing Ringu for the first, you know, like basically going through kind of the staples, I guess, of that time. They're so much more unsettling and, to put it bluntly, terrifying than a lot of either the American counterparts or just American horror cinema in general. Not to say that there's not great American horror films, but from what I've seen, and even some of the more like the Netflix films, like Ravenous was fantastic. That was the German like zombie film. What I'm getting at is I'm wondering if there is something to foreign horror films for Americans consuming it, and why those tend to seem to be a little bit darker. I'm wondering if you've experienced that in your movie watching history.
Oh, absolutely.
Why is that? It's
such a different flavor. Like, I mean, not for nothing, if you think about just the world history of these countries, like, I mean, Germany, where do I even begin?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, Germany is already, you know, it's already wearing, like, you know, like, suspiciously small sunglasses and, you know, a leather trench coat. And it's, you know, it's drinking some of the hardest coffee you've ever had in your life. Just that alone, like that's how I view Germany. And then that seems to come to life in a lot of German films, whether horror or any other kind of genre. There's just an inherent darkness. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that, and like, you know, with other countries, you know, like when you have a filmmaker going into the darkness, you know, especially for a horror film, you know, not for nothing, because of this weird thing called experience, you know, whether, you know, you grew up, you know, worried about the atomic bomb dropping, or you grew up because, you know, there was another coup that took place on the government, or, you know, not being able to eat, this, that, or the other. Like, I feel like a lot of experience, you know, is, you can really see it in the way that horror films are done, you know, across the world. You know, like you look at like China, or not so much, I mean, kind of China, like China and Japan, Vietnam, like, you know, they'll always like try to throw in a little bit of like folklore into their horror films. So it's like rooted to something that's been a story told for like tens of thousands of years. Italy just loves the colors. They have the blood that shines like the nicest marinara that you can drizzle over your pasta. And that's not even an exaggeration. Like, you can watch any of those Fulci films or Argento, yeah, and when they go all out on the gore, it is done, you know, almost with like the joy of a Walt Disney, in the way that it just colors everything. And then you think about, you know, the art of the Renaissance from Italy, and it's just so colorful at the same time. Again, this thing of like experience that, you know, if you grew up, you know, studying the classics of art, and now it's your turn to make someone's neck explode, you know, maybe it is kind of like a subliminal callback.
I think you're onto something too with experience, because a number of those nations that we've, well, nations, former kingdoms, empires, etc., the United States, is, as we know, is still a relatively young nation, and its filmmakers, although they come from other countries such as those that we've named, overall the country is still new versus, you know, as you said, Italy, the Renaissance, you know, the spotted past of Germany, even back to like the Germanic Empire and you know, things like that, right? The barbarians and the tribes that existed pre-Holy Roman Empire. It just, there's a much deeper history, a darker history, especially with lore. That's the other thing I think you're on to. Scandinavian films in particular, too.
Can I just say that I don't think the world is ready for the ABBA reunion that's about to happen. Have you been keeping tabs on that, or am I like the only one?
So it's really funny you mentioned that. So my family has this very strange history with ABBA, and it's not just because of Mamma Mia. Like, it is the band ABBA. We have very little Scandinavian blood coursing through our veins. I do not know where it stemmed from, but like my mom, my stepfather, and like my four half brothers and sisters are like obsessed. I provided them with essentially their entire discography on album. I bought them some CDs. So to answer your question, aware of it, I don't know. Is this the mark of the beast? Like, is this the coming of the apocalypse right now? Like, ABBA's, you know, getting ready to tour the world. You know, like, what is going on?
I mean, think about it right now. Like, you got all this crazy shit going on. And I know, like, we're already kind of like in the dark topic of like horror films, but let's go from the fictional to the real world. Like, you got all this, you got fucking global warming. Like, you got like weather history just totally getting just flipped on its side. You have, you know, turmoil within the United States, which is then kind of like seeping, creating a lot of anxiety in like Europe. And like Asia, I'm like, oh my God, is the United States, is this finally going to happen? Like the temper tantrum that we've been waiting on. Canada is just trying to like go, hey, you know, let's try to not focus on that whole indigenous people just being buried with their shoes. Or, you know, actually, no, we'll take the shoes anyways. That's Canada. Like, you got all this crazy shit. And I'm like fooling around on social media, and ABBA's saying, get ready. I'm like, you, what? You guys, like, for one thing, love the songs.
Yeah.
Two, you guys coming back, you're like in your 70s.
Yes.
But maybe this is like something that we need. I don't know.
When I think of that, I think of, okay, what is that live performance going to be like? Because you know they're playing with a backing band, right? It's like, is it going to be as sad as like a current day Brian Wilson concert? Or is it going to be exactly as you said, what the world needs? Is this the Renaissance post-pandemic dark age into the light that we have been searching for? And who would have thought it would have originated from ABBA, right? A palindrome in and of itself.
Yeah, I have one word to throw at you. And I think that when I say it, it's going to be like, I don't know, I think, you know, another part of the glacial you know, thing going on, and the Arctic Sea is going to like fall off, like another piece of, like the Arctic Shelf. Avatar. What? Not Avatar. They're going to have avatars. Okay? Oh, they're going to have, like, instead of Bjorn, Bjorn is going to now be like some young Swedish guy.
Oh, wow.
And instead of, like, what is it, like Gretchen? Or, like, it was like some really, like, awesomely Scandinavian name. It's going to be like, you know, some other young, blonde haired, blue eyed, you know, person. And they're going to, like, manifest the energy and talent, I guess, of these four old rich Scandinavians, and they're gonna, you know, play all the big arenas, and we'll buy the greatest hits again, and it'll be awesome.
Yep, dude, Avatar. You know, I think what's gonna happen is as soon as this episode goes live, somebody, the wrong person's going to hear it, and you're going to get a call from like Virgin Records or whatever label that ABBA is currently chained to, and they're going to fly you in on a helicopter, and then no one's going to hear from you again for a very long time, probably following the 2-year world tour of ABBA, right? Because you know they're going to hit everywhere. They're going to leave their mark everywhere. And you're finally going to come back, and you're going to be this completely, I don't want to say shell of a person, but you're going to come back with a certain glint in your eye. Like you looked into, you saw God's face or something. Like, you're going to come back a little different, and it's going to bolster, it's going to come, you know how you were talking about earlier, call back to like 15 minutes ago, talking about the Bruce Springsteen moment, Black Man, that's going to be, you returning from the heaven's gate, as it were, following this epiphany about the avatars, you're going to come back and give Black Mesa its Bruce Springsteen moment. That's what I believe is going to happen.
All I want to say, you know, to that record label that stumbled upon this podcast is Black Mesa is hungry, and I'm hungry, and I would love to have some food in my cabinet. So maybe if you guys can like take us on, I mean, you can make a songwriter. I mean, I'll write a song for Demi Lovato. I don't care. But let's make it happen.
In the words of ABBA, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance on me. So take a chance on Black Mesa. For those of you that are listening from major or minor record labels, take a chance on Black Mesa. I'm wondering, from like a more influential perspective, which artist or bands truly opened your eyes to like the beauty of the manipulation of the effects for guitar?
That's such a tricky question, because if I were to think about my adolescence, you know, I freaked out any time that Mike McCready from Pearl Jam did a guitar solo. And mind you, he was using stuff that had already been done. Like, he loved Stevie Ray Vaughan and Hendrix. Mm-hmm. So it was just as simple as a Univibe and a wah-wah pedal, a little bit of overdrive, maybe he smashed his guitar or two. And like, the sound is pristine. But if we're talking about like more of the modern day context, to kind of like wear the badge on the sleeve a bit, I mean, I cannot not understate just how vital the band Thrice has been to my development as both a songwriter, as a guitarist, as a sonic architect, whatever you want to call it. Because from them, that's where they became the gateway to so much more for me, you know, in so many different ways, whether it's effect pedal wise, technique. I mean, if you look at it just from the core of it, I mean, Tepe Teranishi and Dustin Kensro, great guitarists, great interplay. Eddie Breckenridge, one of my favorite bass players of all time, where I think a lot of his stuff kind of bleeds to how I handle the sort of rhythmic action, you know, with John and Mesa. But you know, that they were the perfect gateway band for me to discover bands like Haven, you know, for me to discover, God, what was another big one that they threw me into? I think to an extent they threw me into like a band like Mew, you know, where not so much on the sonic end, but like thinking like vocally what you can do. Mm-hmm. But you know, when it comes to like guitar pedal stuff, I mean, you know, Thrice was huge for me in that. I mean, Radiohead, that's an understatement, you know, in terms of how important that they've been, you know, and really another big one, which I'm sure this is where everyone will turn off the podcast. Again, U2's The Edge. Mm-hmm. I will die on that ground. Mm-hmm. I will die on the hill when it comes to how important The Edge is, not just to me, but I think to the vast majority of musicians that, you know, tinker with pedal boards.
I think that's something that oftentimes gets overlooked. I know, obviously, U2 has been the butt of many a joke for many years.
So many jokes.
And I personally, it's like, I am not a huge U2 fan. However, I think that U2 War is a fantastic fucking pop album. It's a great Terrific. Fucking record. It's so good. It was one of my first albums that I got as a kid. I inherited my dad's record collection. That was one of them. So it's like when people kind of shit on, you know, U2 as a band as a whole, it's almost like I can't agree with everything. You know, I can't agree with all of the hate because I'm sorry. It's like anytime I hear Sunday Bloody Sunday, like that's a powerful song for so many reasons. But it's also a great fucking song at its core, right? And it's just, I don't know. I get why people crap on him, but I'm pretty sure that I've heard the fact that The Edge specifically says, I master and tinker with effects. I am not like this insane guitar player. I manipulate the sound. That's what I've learned how to do well, you know? So it's like, I think there was like either a documentary where it was a bunch of guitarists together. I think Jack White was there. The Edge.
Yeah, it might get loud.
Yeah, yes. And didn't he say something along those lines where he's just like, yeah, I'm an effects guy, you know, like I'm sitting here with all these like greats, you know, and here I am. It's almost like Tom Morello, right?
Yeah.
It's like Tom, and I love, you know, Rage Against the Machine. I loved Audioslave, but like, is he a Jimmy Page?
I'll tell you exactly who Tom Morello is. Tom Morello is our generation's Slash.
Oh boy.
And I'll let me explain, because I think it is dead on. Slash, known for Guns N' Roses and, yeah, sure, Velvet Revolver, but what's really the bread and butter for Slash? You had Appetite for Destruction. You had what was it? GNR Lies, you know, with that Patience. You had Use Your Illusions 1 and 2. That's about four records done within the time frame of like what? Like 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, 90, about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. You then have Tom Morello, who, you know, he has Rage Against the Machine and he has an Audioslave too. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy where, you know, he had self-titled, he had Evil Empire, he had the Battle of Los Angeles, then fuck it, we'll throw Renegades in there
too. Sure, sure.
And when it comes to a guy that, you know, he does the one thing and you know exactly what that thing is going to be, Slash, he's got the top hat and you know you're going to get a couple reheated Rolling Stones licks and you're good. With Tom Morello, all we need to do is show up, have his guitar that makes, you know, a little kill switch action and an old whammy, and that's it. What I'm trying to get at is, I know, like, you know, Slash and Tom Morello are going to be important, you know, in like, you know, the guitar scene for, you know, doing what they did, but in terms of being like a pillar, I would not say so.
Right. There's pillars that exist that far exceeded their impact, that directly impacted them, right? You know, like,
oh, yeah.
So it's that's why I said it's like, you know, not definitely not like a Jimmy Page or Stevie Ray Vaughan, or even I would go as far as to say like Roger Waters. You want to talk about like sonic experimentation, but also technically proficient. David Gilmour. Dave Gilmour is a fucking alien.
Dave Gilmour is, when it comes to feel as a guitar player, like if I had an eighth of the amount of feel that he has in the way that he bends his notes, I would be happy. Mm-hmm. And I would be totally content. I just want an eighth of that. Same with someone like Stevie Ray Vaughan. If I had just the chops and just to be able to take the blues and just put, you know, this Texas fried thing on top of it, if I had an eighth of that, I'd be happy. Someone like Jimmy Page, again, one of the sloppiest guitar players, but fundamentally one of the most important, just in the fact that he showed that with just a little bit of blue in terms of his rhythm. He hit the notes, but it was like a little bit of blue in the sense of that it didn't always lock in. But in the grand scheme of things, him, Robert Plant, and John Bonham, and John Paul Jones, and you put all that together, it's incredible.
So my last question, now big news here on the podcast.
Oh, this is the biggest news.
This is the biggest news. Now, we are going to be not only premiering something, I'm going to drop this in after we record the episode, and you know we'll obviously promote it on social media, but you have a new project that is going to be unleashed upon the world, at least the digital world and community, Super Ghost. And the premiere, the world premiere of the single happens here, Death Calling. That is going to be happening after you kind of tell me a little bit about this this project. So I'll give you a platform. I'll give you a soapbox. In my opinion, at least from, you know, listening to that single, it's fucking riff heavy. It's a wailing track, man. It's haunting, but in all the right ways. It still drives. It doesn't feel sluggish. Now, tell me a little bit about this new project. How it began? What have you got in store for us? What's coming down the line?
Super Ghost is a rock and roll band. Oh, no. That would have been perfect if I just left it at that. And I then had to go full circle there for a second. All right, Super Ghost. Basically, long story short, I downloaded Neural Archetypes Gojira plugin so I could play heavy stuff on my computer, and a bunch of songs came out. So, you know, I've always been a fan of, I mean, again, Black Mesa is pretty all over the place in terms of song structure. For me, you know, deep down, I've always been a fan of, you know, like, okay, you got your verse, you got your chorus, hooks, you know, it's very traditional in that sense, but, you know, I just felt, you know, this insane desire to write something, you know, just really heavy and, you know, and also very melodic too. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that, you know, when people check it out, you know, they'll get what I mean when I say that, but you know, it's music that, you know, I felt, you know, being so close to Poughkeepsie and knowing like the music scene that's always been fostered around there and, you know, whether on the punk end or the metal end, you know, a lot of the songs that I wrote, they're basically, you know, love songs towards Poughkeepsie in a way.
Now, is this going to be purely a sonic project? Have you drafted musicians to potentially perform this live? What was the mindset going into it?
Right now, I think it's, you know, anything can happen. Mm. You know, if, you know, someone hears the track on this podcast or elsewhere and goes, hey, you know, do you need a bass player for that? And I'm like, yeah, you know, like I'm entertaining any and all opportunities and offers to bring it to life, you know, which would be nice. And obviously, if, you know, things are safe enough to do it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But, you know, it's one of those things where really time will tell on what will happen.